I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Every year, the question seems to come up, will Kansas City ever get a downtown ballpark? Today, I'll ask a man who knows better than most the ins and outs of what it would take, that city manager Troy Schulte. I'll also ask about all these potholes around town, and we'll explore the idea that while we're all focused on the mayor's race, it's really the city manager who's responsible for getting things done in Kansas City. Then a discussion about discrimination and retaliation in broadcast news. We'll talk with a former local TV reporter and learn about the implications of her semi-successful lawsuit against a previous employer. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The city manager of Kansas City, Missouri, Troy Schulte, is fast approaching his 8th anniversary on the job. That's a long time for a city manager who now faces the prospect of a group of different bosses on the city council whom voters will choose in elections this spring. Meantime, the concerns of residents these days span potholes to airports, with a little downtown baseball stadium thrown into the mix, and not to mention all the snow today. On Thursday, the manager and Mayor Sly James released their annual budget proposal that kicks in on May 1st. The city manager's in the house and he'll take your questions today, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Troy, welcome back. So good to have you here.
Steve, thanks for the invite. Another Chamber of Commerce day here in Kansas City.
I was going to say, let's talk snow and streets. What's the plan for today given the enormity of this storm, Troy?
Well, at the rate the snow's coming down now, we've just declared a phase two snow emergency that'll start at noon and go through Sunday evening.
And what does that mean?
And basically what that does is give the police department the authority to ticket and tow parked cars that are on all of our major snow arterials. So if it's on a major street, whether it's downtown or any of our arterials, and it's a parked car, it's subject to ticketing and towing after noon today. So what we're trying to do is get people to get their cars off the road. That will allow the plows to move through at a quicker pace. It's safer for everybody. We are also encouraging, given the way the snow is coming down and when it's projected to be kind of at its height, we're asking employers if they can kind of stagger their dismissals this afternoon, let people go home at varied times. That'll take the pressure off the evening rush. Again, when streets are at their worst, that'll allow us, again, minimize traffic and allow both our city plows as well as MoDOT and KDOT to do their work. So if people can cooperate and kind of do a staggered afternoon release for employees, most of the kids are already home for school. So this would help us just get this process done. And like we've done probably 7 or 8 times, we'll get the plows out and we'll start cleaning it up.
Well, Fox 4 just measured the snowfall at 1.75 inches so far. And you're hearing that the snowfall might pick up later on in the afternoon.
Yeah, what we're hearing is the worst isn't here yet. It's coming down at maybe a half an inch to an inch an hour with the worst yet to come. So we could have, if this trend continues, about 6 inches of snow by 5 o'clock this afternoon, which will make it difficult for people to get around.
So when it snows this much, do you get crews out shoveling at this point, or do you wait until most of it's fallen?
We get out. We've had 200 crews. We've had 200 trucks out since 7 a.m. They were pre-treating, and now they've shifted to plowing. So we'll keep plowing, and we'll just try to keep it up and keep everything passable. Our focus initially in these at this time is to keep the main streets, the arterials, and our collector roads, which handle the vast majority of our traffic. Keep those clear as much as we can, and then we'll move into the residentials tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
So it'll be tough to navigate in the residential neighborhoods this evening, but we'll be out and we'll work through. But we want to keep the main streets working as much as we can, but we'll just keep running routes, applying salt, and just keeping the plows down and hoping people cooperate and get off the roads and allow us to work.
You know, until today, and I know you've heard this a lot, one of the big concerns was potholes, and now today it's snow, of course, but we've had this freeze-thaw cycle this winter, and that just wreaks havoc on the roads when it comes to potholes. What's your concern as city manager when it comes to managing all this?
Well, people have an expectation that they should be able able to drive on fairly smooth roads. And this kind of a weather cycle where we've had 10-degree weather, 15-degree weather, 20-below wind chill, followed by 50 and 60-degree weather is absolutely the worst. It either needs to stay warm or stay cold from a pothole management standpoint. So what we'll probably have here, based on the forecast of what I'm seeing, is we're going to go through a kind of a hectic weekend, and then the temperatures are going to warm, and all those potholes, new potholes will reappear or old potholes will reopen. So just by comparison, we had last year at this time, through about the first month of January, we had about 400 calls for pothole requests. This same time frame, we've had 1,400.
Oh, my gosh.
So, and there's you're just doing temporary fixes because the asphalt plants, it's too cold on a consistent basis, so it's tough to get hot mix, which allows a permanent fix. So we're doing just what we can to kind of keep the roads passable. People are going to have to be patient, report it to us at 311. When our crews aren't plowing snow or treating ice, they're out filling potholes.
So you really can't fix them permanently right now.
You can't fix it permanently until the weather stabilizes and we can get a different asphalt mix. And one of the things that is good about the budget that the mayor and I submitted yesterday is because of the voter approval of the 1 cent sales tax last year, our street resurfacing budget is going to increase by 70%. That won't help now, but it'll help in future years because it'll allow us to spend more money on just basic road maintenance, which will help long term. A newer road with a newer surface has less chance for snow potholes, but they're still happening even on resurfaced roads that we did last year. We're still getting potholes. So it just takes a little bit of water and all heck breaks loose.
Kansas City City Manager Troy Schulte is my guest. You know, not sure if you've noticed or not, Mr. Manager, but there's a big election for mayor and city council on the horizon here. These are the folks who will become your next set of bosses. I'm just curious, how closely do you, as the city manager, watch all this unfold? I mean, I imagine on one level you can't keep your eyes off it, but how do you approach something like this?
Well, obviously you keep an eye on it to see what the issues are that are driving the conversation, because of the conversations that drive the campaign will become the policy conversations once the election is finished. So we as staff continue to monitor. We're completely neutral as to the process. We're kind of focused on our day-to-day jobs, which are not political. I mean, there's snow removal is one of those issues that people like to say, well, we wish we could figure out a way to do it better, and we're constantly looking for ways to do it better. But it's a resource issue, and so we kind of try to focus on those needs, stay out of it, provide resources to any of the candidates so that hopefully all the candidates are speaking with correct and full information. So we make ourselves available to all of the candidates. And hopefully at the result, we can kind of tweak policies or change policies or go in a different direction. But the day-to-day work for the vast majority of our 7,000 employees continues regardless of who the mayor is, who the manager is, or who the city council is.
I was going to say, maybe it's obvious, Troy, but how important is the relationship between the mayor and the city manager? I mean, you've worked with some very different personalities over the years. How do you respond to that?
Well, I have worked, I've been with the city 20 years, and I've worked with four different mayors, two as city manager. And I can tell you that the relationship between the mayor and manager is absolutely critical.
It sort of has to work.
It has
right?
to work. If it doesn't work, and we went through a period not too long ago with a different mayor and a different city manager where the relationship didn't work. And what it does is it paralyzes city government. Department directors, departmental staff are unsure of the direction they're going. The city manager was unsure of his status from day to day. The mayor had relationship issues to get stuff done, difficulty of reaching across the, you know, we share a door on the 29th floor of City Hall.
There's actually a little passageway between your two offices.
And that door had gotten closed, and it stuck when we tried to reopen it just to try to keep that connection go. So there isn't a day that goes by that I don't talk to the mayor, or he's calling me, or I'm calling him, just to make sure that we're coordinating and making sure that the message is the same from both of us. So if that relationship doesn't work, nothing will work in this organization in terms of being able to convey a direction and an approach to city government.
So when you have a mayoral election like this, and it's for an open seat, do you have a few butterflies in your stomach because you don't know what the outcome might be? You don't know what it might mean for you going forward.
Right. I serve at the discretion of 13 people. It takes
on the city council.
On the city council. So, and obviously, the mayor under our city charter controls the vote. It takes 9 votes of the city council to remove the city manager without the support of the mayor, but only 7 with the support of the mayor. So the mayor is the kind of the key person in determining the tenure of the city manager. So obviously I'm keeping a close eye on it. I think we've got a great field of candidates. I think that the city's blessed with that.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting where the policy conversations come down and what the direction is going forward, whether I'm here or long term, whether I'm here or not. I always tell people I'm well past my half life. You've been around here, Steve. You recognize it.
Because 8 years is a long time.
8 years is a long time, and I served 18 months as acting before that. So I'm in my 10th year as city manager.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the direction of the city's too important to get caught up in the personalities. What are we trying to accomplish? How's the best way to go out and do it? And how do we get as many people involved in that decision making as we can?
Again, City Manager Troy Schulte is in the house. Our number, 816-235-2888. Susan from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Good. How are you doing, Susan?
Doing well. I'm calling from Waldo, and Troy, I won't be jacking with you regarding Blue Nile and my torn-up streets. But I'm wondering, I read today's paper that water rates might be going down, or you're looking for a way to get those things stabilized a bit. And if you're on the campaign trail, and I'm watching many of the candidates right now, in the city, water rates are a hot topic. Is there really any real hope that we're going to be able to get, at least keep them from rising so quickly?
Yeah, let me just interject. Under the proposed budget, Susan, sewer rates would rise by about 6%, water rates by 2%. That's less than the double-digit raises we've seen in recent years as a result of that consent decree with the EPA that's demanding that the city rebuild its sewer system. Troy, I just want to put that out there.
We're in negotiations with the Environmental Protection Agency for about the last probably a year. We're hoping to wrap that up. It's been a very productive process. Since 2005, our sewer rates in Kansas City have gone up 291%. Mm. We met all of our requirements from the consent decree. We're one of the few cities in the country that signed one of these agreements.
And lived up to it,
mm-hmm. which has allowed us, I think, to go back to the federal government and say, we did this. We did our share of what was required. Our folks are hurting because of the cost, and that they've been receptive to that. So we're hopeful that we can get a new environmental agreement done for the next 17 years of the plan, and the days of double-digit rate increases are over. We're hoping that we can get, if the federal government goes along with it, average sewer increases of 4% a year going forward. So 6 and then eventually 2, but of averaging over 4. So we're hopeful. We're not there yet, but hopefully there won't be any more federal shutdowns and we can get that agreement done. We'd like to get that agreement done by the summer.
Karen from Kansas City, Missouri. You're on Up to Date, Karen.
Hi there. Thank you very much for taking my call on this incredibly snowy day.
Yeah.
I wanted to call the city manager and just ask him about, so I love the 311 system. It's been the best thing the city has done as far as communicating, so you have a clear way of reaching out. The trouble I have with 311, especially because I live in the stepsister Northland where we don't get very good services many times, my road hasn't been plowed in the last 3 snowstorms at all, is when you do file a 311 Action Center complaint, the department managers are able to just close those out without communicating back to the citizen. So as a result of that, many times I'll try and call the city manager and be like, this is not okay because I've asked for a call back because it's a concern. And I love that you've been there a long time, but you're a little too big now and you aren't reachable. Your staff won't let us reach you. There's no direct communication. So I just feel like that 311 system is awesome, but the follow-up for especially the Northlanders, we have a lot of trouble out here.
Okay, Karen, let's let Troy Schulte respond.
Well, Karen, I live up north, so I see the same things that you're seeing, when we've had some issues with our trash and recycling contractor up north, and I've been the beneficiary of those missed trash collections, missed recycling as well. What we try to do is as we close a case, if there's an email provided, we try to provide a follow-up as to what the action was that was taking place. Sometimes we get a lot of anonymous complaints, so it's difficult to follow up on those. I am always, if you want a direct response, my staff tries to make sure that the appropriate departments handle it. But if you want to get a hold of me, you can go directly to manager@kcmo.org or troy.schulte@kcmo.org. And I try to respond individually to those or make sure that the departments that have a question. So I get a lot of questions about water bills. I get a lot of questions about trash collection. I get probably about 1,000 emails a day, both internally and externally. But I try to, as my wife and family will suggest, I try to do that in the evenings, working through those. So if you don't hear directly from me, don't get discouraged. Just keep pestering me and we'll get your response. We try to do that 311 is make sure that if we've got an email, we don't probably do as well as we should on phone calls just because we've not a lot of people in a big city and a lot of response. But if you give us an email, we'll try to get you either an automated response or some sort of a follow-up. So don't hesitate to contact me by email or and I'll try my best to get a hold of you.
Okay, let's go to Rydell from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I was listening to you guys and just wanted to let Mr. Schulte know, residential drivers, we are already out now. They had told us to go out at noon.
You're a snowplow driver yourself, right?
Yes, I am for the city. Yes, sir.
Doing a half a job. And, Rydell will be working all weekend. So it'll take us a while to dig back out of this. So.
Yeah, they told us to start at 12 today, but a lot of us, we got out this morning, we're getting our trucks ready, and about 10:30, we thought, you know what, we just better go now. So we're already out trying to get a handle on this as best we can.
Well, we appreciate you, Rydell, and good luck out there. I appreciate your service to the city. You know, City Manager, I want to go back to the budget that you just announced yesterday. You proposed spending about $9 million from the city's reserve fund, a move you admitted is unsustainable in the long run. Why spend out of the reserve fund?
Well, that is it's reserves. We're not spending out of the city's main reserve fund, which is the general fund reserve fund. We have $100 million in that reserve fund. What we're doing is using reserves in like our motor fuel tax fund or our park maintenance fund or our health levy to kind of continue operations, do some restructuring. So in the parks fund, we're using it to buy one-time equipment. Same thing in our motor fuel tax fund. So it's not a sustainable approach, but the good thing when you have a reserves, you can invest in equipment. So one of the things that we're investing that Rydell will be doing if he's in public works is we're going to add equipment for rural mowing because we have to mow city streets and right away 9 months out of the year when we're not pushing snow. So we're going to add equipment. We're using reserves to pay for that equipment. And then it'll give us additional snow removal capacity. We'll have more trucks, more people to do that. So we try to use a judicious use of it. But the big reserve fund, which is our general fund, we're not touching that. There's about $100 million in that account. And I can tell city councils and mayors since 2005 have been diligent in adding that. I can remember when the ambulance service got in trouble in 2005, we did an emergency allocation to the ambulance service of $4.5 million, and we had $4 million in the bank.
Wow.
So
wow.
We've gone from essentially zero to $100 million through one of the worst economic downturns with the Great Recession, and we built reserves in every one of those years. So that's a tremendous accomplishment, I think, all the mayor and city council for the last decade have said, this is important. We're going to make sure that we've got a rainy day fund that works.
You're proposing to add no new police officers. You added some a year ago, but 15 new firefighters. What's the demand there?
We have not. We have seen about a 10% increase in our number of EMS calls over the last 5 years.
That's the primary work of firefighters these
days.
About
85% to 90% of the calls in the fire department are EMS related. So they're classified as firefighters, but they will become paramedics. Mm-hmm. And that's where we have that's a hard job. They're running a lot of calls. There's a lot of burnout. It's driving some of our overtime issues because we have a minimum staffing requirement. We've got to keep 40 ambulances out on the street every day. So it's a kind of a job that churns. It's a tough job. So we're going to try to make sure we keep up with the fatigue and the call volume. So last year we did police. They're in the process of filling their positions this year. we'll add firefighter paramedics, and then we'll probably go back to do police. Public safety is such a large part of the budget, we can't do investments in both at the same time mm-hmm. without crowding out those other services.
Again, it's roughly three-quarters of the yes. city general fund going to public protection, public right. safety, right?
Right?
Yeah.
Right.
You know, no money proposed for a $75 million housing trust fund that some council members have kicked around as a way to address affordable housing. Just no money for it?
At this point, we don't have a set kind of a policy direction. There's been some recommendations that we use like a developer payment mechanism, or Mayor Pro Tem Wagner has proposed a property tax that could potentially go on the November ballot.
Right.
So we kind of we use the budget document to kind of reflect past policy changes. And since that's still an unsettled approach, and obviously we'll get an approach that will hopefully get resolved over the next year. You'll see it in future budgets. But at this point, we're continuing to provide information to staff, to council, and see where they want to go. There's a variety of ways to fund it. You're probably going to need a new revenue stream to make that number work. But it's probably the magnitude that we need. A $75 million program over 10 years would start to change the dynamic about housing in the city.
You know, different topic. How confident are you, Troy, that this city will get the federal dollars it needs to expand the streetcar this calendar year? The proposal is to bring it from Union Station out to UMKC here. Is that going to happen this year?
I don't think it'll happen this year. What I hope to see happen is I would be surprised and pleased if it was incorporated into President Trump's budget. What I think will probably happen is we'll rely on our congressional delegation to help it get it added as an eligible project.
Mm-hmm.
If it allows us to get it added as an eligible project, we can then turn on our local that expanded transportation development district, start collecting revenues, allow us to complete design, and then hopefully get the dollars in place so that we're ready for construction in 2021. So we don't have to have it right now, but we've got to probably have it in the next 2 years. So we've got to kind of lay the groundwork.
You know, another issue that people are really interested in is sort of this ongoing low burner conversation about a downtown baseball stadium. Obviously, the leases don't expire for another 10, 12 years, but I know you're part of the ongoing conversations here. What's the latest? What can you tell people about what might be happening?
There is a group that's been engaged, some downtown stakeholders that have been engaged for a number of years, going back to before the stadiums were renovated back in 2005, 2007, to see what it would take to bring a baseball stadium downtown. The city got involved simply because of the land use planning that goes with it. You need probably at a minimum 12 to 14 acres of land.
You've got to reserve that.
You've got
land
to reserve
now.
It, or yeah. you're losing development sites. So there was some ideas. You look at these new downtown ballparks that are built around the country. They're built in proximity to transit, and they're built in proximity to entertainment districts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that narrows the field, and I'm probably one that believes we probably can't support that many more entertainment districts. So you start to narrow your options. And at the rate downtown is being redeveloped, there was a site that had originally been proposed that would sit at basically between 12th and 13th Street, just east of Grand Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
Would have been ideal, two blocks from the streetcar, just across the street from the Power and Light District, just north of the Sprint Center. But we've had development of those surrounding. So those properties aren't available.
They're off the table.
So from a long-term planning standpoint, I think the city needs to be involved. That the only ones who will make this decision, you can have downtown advocates, you can have the only ones who will ever make this decision will be the Kansas City Royals.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, have you gotten even a wink or a nod from David Glass, the owner of the Royals? Would he consider such an idea of a downtown baseball park?
I haven't been privy to the conversations myself, but I've heard from others that he is saying, give us some options. And they have made no commitments one way or the other. One of the things
he hasn't said no.
He has not said no. And so that they have asked that the Major League Baseball architect, which is located in Kansas City, get involved in that process. So there's private money trying to engage that group on that process. So and that's Populous is the mm-hmm. the group that does most of those baseball stadiums for Major League Baseball. So they've been engaged. Again, ultimately, it'll be a proposal that the Royals will say yay or nay. From a city perspective, we've got to not only have the site, but we've got to figure out what's it going to take to pay for it. What are the Royals going to do? Those stadiums will be 60 years old in 2031. What's the likelihood of rehab? It's no too early to start planning. But again, there's nothing. I don't think it may not even affect the 2023 mayoral and city council candidates. So,
Do you have a site in mind as a city manager today, Troy?
Well, I think one of the issues that if there were sites, it's got to be probably in that downtown adjacent area.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that East Village is an area where there's a lot of publicly controlled land. Just east of the county courthouse, east of City Hall. It's got proximity.
It gets you a few blocks away from the streetcar.
But there's been some conversations about could you do something around 18th and Vine.
Wow.
And so you start to look at some of those areas. It's at this point we're just trying to figure out given the demand patterns, what's going to work, what do the Royals want, what can the city and the county and the state reasonably afford. These ballparks are $700-800 million investments.
Yeah, right.
So it's going to be a big lift. The city can't do it by itself. So
it's exciting though. It's an exciting idea.
It is. And if you look at what other ones, these ballparks are being built in more urban settings around the country. So I think that conversation is going to be around for the next few years from a city perspective. I just don't want to be surprised and say, well, we should have thought about this back in 2018 or 2020. Mm-hmm. And some future decision maker will go, well, I wish the city would have been involved in this process earlier. So we'll see where that goes. There are some passionate people involved.
Who are some of those stakeholders?
Well, they've asked to keep kind of anonymous, and it's a private working group.
Sure.
But I think you'd recognize most of the people, most of the names, most of the companies involved. They're kind of trademarked downtown Kansas City or big names in Kansas City,
yeah.
Missouri. So it's kind of just a working group that have engaged the Royals and say, what would it take? What would you want? What are your desires? What are your needs? Can they make it work? And from a city perspective, I'm just in to make sure that we have the land, have the transportation issues. If they decide to do something, we're not surprised and have to deal with a huge unplanned expense 10 years from now.
The other project you've mentioned the last time you were here and we talked about a little bit was this notion of putting a deck over the downtown freeway as a way to connect the downtown with the Crossroads District. This would be – give us a sense of where this would be.
There's a concept that would put a lid basically west of Grand Avenue over to Wyandotte. So basically from –
Baltimore Wyandotte.
So basically from the convention center where the convention center crosses 670 over to Grand Avenue, it would be four blocks. There's an estimate of $150 million to construct that. Mm-hmm. Again, it's a project that the city can't do itself, but you look at what St. Louis did, a lid project to connect the arch with the downtown, Clyde Warren Park in Houston. More and more of these cities are looking at this to create a green space, provide connectivity issues.
Right.
And so, again, a group of downtown stakeholders interested in that, but it's going to take federal money, philanthropic money, state money, probably city money to make it happen. It's a long-term project. One of the things I've asked for and encouraging downtown and civic interest to do is we probably need a new downtown strategic plan.
That's interesting.
Because we have basically, with the construction of the downtown convention center hotel, have completed everything that was identified 20 years. It took us 20 years to do a downtown arena, do an expanded ballroom, provide a performing arts center, deal with a downtown entertainment district, downtown housing. All of that was identified in mm-hmm. that original Sasaki plan. It's probably time for another plan that gets community consensus, community buy-in, and kind of sets the what do we do for the next 20 or 30 years, because these are long-term projects.
Let's go back to some phone calls here for City Manager Troy Schulte. Let's go to Barbara from the Kansas City, Missouri, Raytown area. Barbara, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm in the Kansas City, Missouri limits, but I'm on the edge of Raytown. My complaint or problem is I manage a group of apartments, but there are other owners that have different management people. These other owners live in the state of California. I think they used it as an investment opportunity. They have, the owners or management company are not taking care of a large area of the grass that is, that I used to keep up, which is the entry into our area. So it's all overgrown. Then people start throwing the trash out.
Give me a question here for the manager, Barbara, if you would.
What can I do to get this back up? Because we're becoming a blighted area.
Are you tracking their...
Yeah, I'll tell you what. We're tracking about 14,000 code violations across the city. And a lot of them are LLCs or out-of-city property owners that are difficult to get enforcement on. I'll tell you, send me an email with that particular address. Send it to me directly at manager@KCMO or at troy.shulde@kcmo.org. And I'll look into it. And what we've got is we've got dedicated legal folks, and we've now got some dedicated crews that go out and clean the property, and then we bill the property owner. So if it's bad enough, call us and we'll try to step up enforcement. No guarantees. It's not a quick fix. If people don't maintain their property, we have to go through due process. But we write a lot of violations, and again, we're tracking 14,000 code violations on an annual basis in this city.
That's City Manager Troy Schulte from Kansas City. Troy, always appreciate you taking some time, giving us an update, and good luck with the streets today. Okay,
happy to be here, Steve.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, former KSHB TV reporter Lisa Benson Cooper joins us to talk about her highly charged race discrimination lawsuit against her former station. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we met the leader of a new tenant power organization in Kansas City. She wants to help renters know their rights and fight for better housing conditions. Hear that and other previous conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Monday, what is the dark store theory? It sounds very ominous, but it could mean a big property tax cut for big box retailers like Walmart and Target. We'll learn more on Monday. Well, the verdict for former KSHB TV reporter Lisa Benson, decidedly mixed. That was the outcome of her highly charged race discrimination and retaliation lawsuit against her station. KCUR's Dan Margulies reports that a jury found for the TV station and its owner, Scripps Media Incorporated, on her race discrimination claims. But the jury found for Lisa Benson Cooper on her retaliation verdict. The jury awarded her $26,000 in actual damages and $175,000 in punitive damages. It was, as I said, a partial victory, and Lisa Benson Cooper joins me now. Nice to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks for the invitation.
And she's joined by her lawyer, Marty Myers. He's the founder of the Myers Law Firm and served as co-counsel on the case. Marty, welcome to you too.
Thanks, Steve. Good morning.
Well, Lisa, a mixed result for you in this case. Is that how you view it?
Yes. On some level, absolutely. I was happy. And I felt vindicated that the jurors heard my story and believed me.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the discrimination case, they could only take it back to 2013. I'd been an employee of E.W. Scripps since 2004, and I'd started applying for jobs shortly after that. So I understood with the variables in play for the jurors how they came to that decision. But when I looked at the totality of my experience there, there definitely was a different story in my mind. Mm-hmm.
Marty, how about you? Is this a mixed verdict in your eyes?
Well, sure it is. You know, we would have liked to have won the race verdict as well, but part of the challenge in a federal court case is the unanimous verdict requirement, which mm-hmm. is one of the things that I'm highly critical of, just because it so empowers the sort of holdout minority to compromise the verdict.
In other words, you need a unanimous judgment from the jury to award a discrimination case like this.
Well, in any civil action, you need a unanimous vote of the jurors. So that is that's the case in Missouri in criminal cases. But in Missouri civil cases, it's 9 out of 12. In Kansas, it's 10 out of 12.
Right. You know, Lisa, this was, again, a case of race discrimination. That's a heavy-duty charge. And obviously, you felt deeply wronged here. And I'm guessing this was pretty painful because you worked at the station for 14 years.
It was. It was very difficult going through the reality of working there and looking for opportunities that just simply were not available to me. And then to be in the courtroom and to hear people tell stories about me that were not necessarily associated with me. In opening statements, they described me as an angry, black, violent woman. And that was very hurtful considering those would be the same people who would have sent flowers to the maternity ward when I gave birth. So it was very, I learned a lot going through this process.
What was the last straw for you? What made you decide to sue the station and to sue Scripps?
It would have been just realizing that I was never going to have a voice. No matter how many times I went to HR, corporate HR, inside this particular corporation, I was not going to be heard. So I had to go outside of the building, if you will, so that I could have a voice. So that means I'm filing an EEOC complaint. That means I'm contacting an attorney because I just was not being heard inside of those walls.
You say not being heard, meaning what?
Any opportunities. I had been applying for jobs with EW Scripps since 06. So I just did not understand why I just did not get an opportunity for growth at all. So at the point of me filing the complaint with the EEOC, it was because I legitimately didn't understand why I kept applying for jobs and I just was not eligible for any opportunities.
To be specific, you had complained that you had been passed over for a weekend morning anchor position in 2013 and for a job as a consumer investigative reporter in 2015 because of race. Why were you so convinced that race was the motivation here?
Understanding the jurors could only go back to 2013 because essentially that's what the courts say. But for me, my life began at EW Scripps in 2004. So I had been looking for opportunities since I walked in the door to grow. And obviously, when you move in position, you move in pay too. So just like my counterparts, I wanted to grow into position, grow in money. And so I understand, obviously, the jurors could only consider so much. But for me, when I went outside of that building and started filing complaints, it wasn't from 13. It was from all the way from when I first started applying for jobs.
You said in your suit that your race was, and I'm quoting, constantly used in deciding where or what topics you would be reporting on. The station denied that, but explain that part of it to us.
And some of these incidents would have happened again before 2013, but I absolutely believe that my race factored into the types of stories I covered, where I covered the stories. I mean, one example would have been me being sent to the home of a known KKK member by myself. I knew that I was sent into that neighborhood, into that situation as an agitator, if you will, as a woman of color. And I didn't mind being sent in as a woman of color, but I did mind being sent alone. So, and there were other situations as an MMJ that I was sent to cover.
MMJ meaning?
Multimedia journalist. Mm-hmm. Essentially, I'm a one-man band reporter. Again, I'm setting the stories up. I'm shooting them.
That's the new way of journalism these days.
Exactly. Yeah. And so doing that alone and covering stories in neighborhoods where you're knocking on doors by yourself, just think about the dynamic. If you're by yourself and you're going to going into an apartment complex, you're knocking on the door asking someone to grant you an interview. If they open the door and say, yes, I will grant the interview, and you walk inside and close the door, you are now at their will. Mm-hmm. You know? And so if they have ill will towards you, what can you do? You're simply their victim. And so actually back then, I actually drafted MMJ guidelines, safety guidelines for the company that they adopted at that time because I was so concerned about not only my safety, but the safety of the other people in the newsroom who at the time I considered my friends.
Former KSHB reporter Lisa Benson Cooper is my guest. To be fair, the station felt otherwise, saying you weren't given the positions, these promotions, because you didn't apply for them. In fact, the station said you were on maternity leave when the weekend anchor position came up. Is that true?
I did apply for multiple positions with EW Scripps. Mm-hmm. I applied for multiple positions.
Beyond the two I've mentioned here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And including the two you mentioned.
Okay. The station also said there were other more qualified applicants. Would you say you met all or most of the qualifications in the job descriptions for the anchor and reporter positions you applied for?
Yes, I believe that I did. Absolutely, I met the qualifications. I just believe, and I still do believe, that at the time I just wasn't eligible. I mean, again, they went back to 2013. I go back to 2004, 5, 6. So, yes, I was just as qualified. In fact, there were other general assignment reporters who were hired under me, who were promoted over me, who went into investigative roles. So the idea that I wasn't qualified, well, they wouldn't have been qualified either. It's just a matter of who they're willing to give the opportunity for growth and who they're not willing to give the opportunity for growth.
Marty Myers, weigh in here. How do you view this? How open and shut a case was this in your mind?
Well, it was a difficult case in terms of being limited to what Lisa's situation was. But when you sort of zoom back and look at the station as a whole, you saw a lot of repetition of that. And, of course, that's one of the challenges in the court cases. How broad can you go? How much evidence can you bring in with respect to other people's positions? But, for example, that investigative reporter position, it was a little complicated in that Lisa was told, expressed interest in the story, was told, you don't qualify for this reason. She accepted that at face value. And then the person that they hired didn't have that additional experience either. So she finds out after the fact, and they say, well, you withdrew from the position. Well, yeah, she withdrew because of the representation that that was a requirement. And then it turns out it wasn't a requirement.
Yeah. Hey, what's that feel like to you? What did that feel like to you at the time?
You mean back in 2015 when I applied?
Yeah, you're getting passed over like that.
Well, at that point, again, I've been on staff since 2004. So it was almost like the light was starting to brighten for me to see that no matter what I did, I was not going to be given the opportunity for growth. So it was hurtful. But at that point, you want to do something. You still think that if you, you know, it's like you go up the food chain and you tell people what you're going through and you talk to HR, you talk to corporate HR, that at some point you're going to have a voice. People are going to hear what you're saying. And that just simply never happened. But it was very hurtful. And at the time, I didn't understand why I wasn't being given the same opportunity for growth that others were.
Because did you ever take a manager aside and just sort of say, hey, what's it going to take for me to advance in this company?
We've had multiple news directors, but every news director I've ever had, I absolutely had that conversation with. I had that conversation with HR. I had that conversation with corporate HR. It's just the reality of as far as who is eligible for these opportunities and who is not.
You know, in covering this story for KCUR News, Dan Margulies reported this. The station, he wrote, went further, saying it had legitimate reasons unrelated to race for suspending and later terminating Lisa. It pointed to what it described as an inflammatory article in the Guardian newspaper about white privilege that you had shared on your private Facebook page. And it said she posted an African proverb that caused additional consternation. The proverb stated, the child who is not embraced by the village will burn it down to feel its warmth. Some might consider that threatening. What do you say?
The African proverb was from the movie Black Panther. That was the first movie I'd ever taken my boys to, and they loved it, and I loved it, and I loved my little brown children seeing a black superhero. So I don't know how they associated that meme on my personal Facebook page to the station, but they did.
You thought they were reaching.
Absolutely. And in the event that they... I didn't understand why, understanding by the time I got the connections they were making, I didn't understand why no one called me and said, Lisa, this is on your Facebook page. What's going on? They never did that. Mm-hmm. And so why, understand that posting would have happened at 9 o'clock on a Wednesday night after I put my boys to bed. So I don't know how they would look at that meme and think it had anything to do with work, because it absolutely did not. It had everything to do with the Black Panther movie, which my family loved.
I should point out, we reached out to KSHB this morning, and we haven't gotten a response yet. The station also said gave other reasons for its actions. It said that you and your husband had failed to pay your taxes for 5 years, that you had yelled at a supervisor, and that you were untruthful when interviewed by an outside investigator hired by Scripps. Marty, any of these situations valid grounds for dismissal in your view?
Well, they're slight misrepresentations of the facts. I mean, the failure to pay the taxes, there was a failure to file returns. When the returns were filed, there was actually a refund due to the Cooper. So it wasn't a non-payment situation. It was a you know, sloppy filing situation. And that was known to the station 6 to 8 months before they took the action
But why would filing of your tax returns be a matter, a condition of employment? I was trying to think, any job I've had, whether I paid my taxes on time or a month late, and I pay them on time, but why would that be a concern to anybody?
Well, it wouldn't be. That was our point. And, you know, if it was a concern, then we asked, why didn't you go up and down the line and ask other people for proof that they had, you know, timely filed their returns? I mean, it was a pretext for discrimination. These other issues were exaggerated as well. The yelling at another reporter. One of the, I think,
things. A supervisor or a reporter, Marty?
It was a supervisor. It was an alleged yelling at a supervisor. That went from being a characterized as a disrespectful tone in her voice at the time to an outright screaming campaign. So they exaggerated that. And we had an instance where we had a white producer who was on a profanity-laden rant against an African-American reporter in the newsroom with 50 people present, and no action was taken about that against that person at all. So it was just a constant disparity of treatment between African-American employees and white employees.
But again, the jury didn't find discrimination here. It just found the retaliation thing. That means what, Marty? Explain that to me in legalese here.
Well, they were different events. So we had differential treatment of blacks compared to whites in the overall newsroom. But with respect to the specific positions, they were limited to assessing the question of whether Lisa's race was a factor in the denial of those promotions. And they found that it was not.
Mm-hmm. And retaliation means what then?
Well, retaliation is...
That was found in Lisa's favor.
Right. So the action was taken against her because she had asserted the rights, because she had asserted a belief that she was being subjected to discrimination. You have an absolute right to make that allegation and be free from retaliation from your employer for doing that.
But again, you didn't have supervisors coming to you, Lisa, and saying, hey, what are you doing posting this stuff to Facebook?
No one mentioned the Guardian article. No one mentioned the meme to me. In fact, when I was suspended back in May, they suspended me for creating a hostile work environment based on race and sex. And that's all they would tell me. So the initial suspension, I didn't even know why I was at home. And based on what they did give me, I had no idea it had anything to do with social media. So I didn't find that out until we met with the investigator, which would have been, I guess, a little over a week after my suspension. And even then, they wouldn't tell me. They showed me the article, the Guardian article, and they showed me a picture of the meme. But then they wouldn't tell me who the employees were who were offended. So that's why I went back to my personal Facebook page and trying to essentially unfriend every coworker, because I didn't understand what I could have done on my personal Facebook page that would have been that offensive. So, at the time I had no idea. And they did not bring it to my attention. They simply told me that I had created a hostile work environment based on race and sex.
Are there further legal actions to come here, Marty? Where do we go here? I got 30 seconds left.
Sure. We anticipate the defendant will file post-trial motions, file an appeal. We're going to file claims for additional relief that are reserved to the judge as opposed to the jury. So, yeah, the story's not over.
Okay. That was Marty Myers, co-counsel on this case involving Lisa Benson Cooper, the former reporter for KSHB-TV. We'll keep watching. Thanks for coming in and sharing your story today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks.
Yesterday on the show, a man who climbed to unimaginable heights. We met a writer and professional climber who turned his amazing skill into a boon for science. Find that and other episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. Monday, the possibility of another recession is real, so the smart money experts share their advice for how to prepare and when. Our theme music is composed by Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Brian Ellison, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske. Have a great weekend, all. Stay safe out there. And you are up to date.